You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. This week, we are brewing around Yorion Sky Nomad, a powerful new addition from Ikoria, Lair of Companions. After that, we open up the Brewer's Mailbag and field listener questions on everything under the sun. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 51 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joining you from a heavily fortified quarantined compound in the Twin Cities. I am joined, as always, by my guy on the left coast. No longer a hot spot due to the actions of his governor, Damon Alexander. Damon, what's going on?
Hey. We just had a run of really wonderful weather in Seattle, put to an end by clouds and rain today. But we'll see if we can keep that run continuing. I've heard this saying of, we can take the parachute off. It slowed my fall so far.
Yeah. I think we're going to learn a little bit of a lesson about multiplicative risk as the years continue here. A man who knows all there is to know about multiplicative risk is the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Cave Dan Online. He's Cave Dan Reborn. Dan Shriver, what's going on?
It's good to be here. Good to see your faces.
Yeah, we were Zooming or whatever before it was fashionable due to our location. So it's just old hat. The virus has not affected our recording technique other than the fact that we've got a lot more free time. So we do have some exciting announcements. They have nothing to do with Ikoria, luckily. And that is we have some new patrons. And Dan is going to talk a little bit about our stretch goal here. So first, we want to give a shout out to our new patrons. They are Jack H., Red Sox, shout out to Boston maybe, James L., and Matt C. Thank you very much to those of you who are current or continue to be our patrons. Thank you very much to our new patrons. And we did hit our stretch goal. So Dan, you want to talk a little bit about that?
We did hit our stretch goal. And David, I am so excited about this. I'm so excited. So this was our custom token stretch goal. What I had in mind was that we would get an artist to create some Faithless Brewing themed tokens that people could use to represent for the Faithless family. And we are doing that. But I also thought, you know what? Wait a second. This is episode 51. It's been almost a full year since we started this podcast. And these are weird times with the pandemic and everything else happening in the world. So you know what? Let's just go all out and make it a big celebration. Let's just do everything. So that's what we're doing. We found an amazing artist who's going to be working on custom tokens for us. They've also worked up a brand new logo, which you can already see in your podcast player. It's a little golden Niv-Mizzet sipping on his Faithless Brew. That logo is a little more merch ready than our previous logo, I have to say. Something that I think we can get put onto a bunch of different stuff and make that available for our supporters. We're also having playmats done. We're having some fun little sticker sheets made up with our logo and with brewing theme slogans and daily affirmations. Things like that that you can use to show off your fine taste in Magic the Gathering podcasts. We're having a new backdrop made up that will go on our Twitter feed at FaithlessMTG. So it's all happening. All of that is in the works, and all of that is made possible by the very generous support of our patrons, old and new. So thank you again to everyone who listens to us, supports us, shares our content, likes and retweets us, or leaves us Apple reviews. If you would like to join our patron community, we would love to have you. You can come hang out with us in the Discord. You can get access to our extended show notes for each episode. And there are other fun perks thrown in as well. Like this episode, for example, we are opening up our Brewer's Mailbag, and our patrons came through with a ton of great questions that we're going to answer on air. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is the place where you can sign up.
Yeah, excellent. Exciting times. So in the spirit of new things, we've gotten some of our first impressions of Ikoria. And the one thing that seems to be the case is that companions, despite some of the insistence from the establishment, seem to be broken in multiple formats. Yeah, I mean, I haven't played any games with them yet. I've watched quite a few. Yeah, they function the way that I think anyone who understands how magic works knew that they would. There's almost no surprises, honestly.
Well, apparently Lutri sucks, which is sad.
That was the one we were actually pretty confident wasn't broken, so...
Yeah. Somebody pointed out that, like, it's a really cool restriction, actually. Like, being a Highlander, that would open up a lot of, I think, really good magic gameplay, because Highlander gameplay just has a lot of appealing features to it. But getting, like, this kind of dual caster mage thing is just not actually that good.
Yeah, and so one of the issues of the Highlander thing is it creates all these unique gameplays. What we're finding out with companions is the reason they're powerful is they create the same gameplay over and over again. So this is the one commander that leads to actual unique game states, and that's a bad part of the companions. They're made to just make the exact same game over and over again, like chess, so you don't have to do anything new or novel in each individual game. Lutri doesn't lend to that, so it's not broken.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, if it was a really good card, it would be an interesting balance to see, like, does the companion kind of repetitiveness balance against the Highlander uniqueness to kind of give you something that is more or less varied than decks without companions? But we'll never know because the card just doesn't seem that good.
Yeah, it'd be cool if it was like a 3-2 flash, and then during your like main phase, it casts an instant or sorcery from your graveyard, like the Grixis 3-4 creature or something.
Oh, yeah, Kess.
Yeah, like if it was like a Kess-like effect.
Yeah. Even like a Snapcaster Mage.
They would never print a companion like that. That would be crazy. Like a 3-mana creature that just gave you a free card every turn.
Yeah, that would be too good.
Why would they ever do that?
Yeah, there's no reason to.
What's interesting, Dave, is I'm not sure I agree with what you're saying. In the sense that watching a lot of these games, a lot of the decks that run companions, the companions are still not exactly on curve the best thing that a deck in Modern can be doing. And really, they seem to be coming out a lot of the times as like you play this Bogles deck or whatever. And your A plan is always just play Bogles, play Enchantments, go try to kill them. And then like turn 5 or turn 6 when you've run out of steam from your opponent's removal is when you start looking to play your Lurrus. And likewise with Yorion, like you'd rather play your kind of cheaper effects and develop a pretty wide board state. And eventually when you have a wide enough board or nothing else to do is when you cast Yorion.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think the one issue that people are learning, which is I think a good point that you made in our preview podcast, is that they really can clear up a lot of space at the mana cost of their companion. You don't need that many 5-drops if you're going to play Obosh. You don't need to play that many 5-drops if you're going to play Yorion, and you certainly don't need that many 3-drops if you're playing Lurrus, because that's often, as you're saying, you want to do all those things up to the point where you're playing your companion. So the companion kind of lords over the specific mana cost in question.
Yeah, you can play a deck that is much more explosive and runs would otherwise risk running out of steam because you have a little bit of extra steam in the tank.
Right.
I don't know how steam engines work, actually, but maybe they have tanks.
I want to revisit that no surprises point, David, because I was very surprised that one of the companions, specifically Gyruta Doom of Depths, I should say that we're recording in like the very, very earliest stages of these cards being available online, so there aren't a lot of published results. But there are plenty of people on Twitter or on Reddits where you can watch streamers trying out these decks. And there's a lot of hype, but not a lot of hard numbers. What really surprised me was that people just latched on to Gyruta, which I had rated as the most difficult companion to use because I didn't think you could build a deck with all even converted mana costs. But what I missed was that you can construct the deck in such a way that you don't just get value off the Gyruta. You actually just win the game immediately as soon as you cast it. How was that possible? Well, it turns out that line that we were describing in our preview show about Gyruta finding a second copy of Gyruta, giving you kind of a re-spin on the mill to like look for something else. Well, what if you just keep looking for more Gyrutas? What if you fill the deck with clone effects, many of which cost 4, so they're eligible? You can have the clone come in as a copy of Gyruta, and then you end up just re-triggering consistently, right? Gyruta finds another Gyruta, finds a clone, becomes Gyruta, spin again, and before you know it, you've milled almost your entire deck. I don't know which format this started in, but it's taken over Standard Ladder. People are trying it in Modern. People are trying it in Legacy. Turn 1 kills with Lion's Eye Diamond. People are trying it in Pioneer. It already top 4'd the Pioneer Super Qualifier on the first weekend. So that deck is really cool and uses some interactions that we just didn't consider that well. Specifically, I'm talking about the card Spark Double, which is a 4-mana clone that when it comes into play, it circumvents the legendary clause, so you'll get a copy of Gyruta, but it's a non-legendary Gyruta. So you actually end up with 2 6-6s, plus another trigger. Then any future clones can actually become the Spark Double, so that they also will have that avoid the uniqueness of the legendary clause. And from there, you can just sort of keep going. Maybe you won't mill the entire deck, but you can at least get far enough that you find either something like a Dragonlord Kolaghan to give all your 6-6s haste, or like a Thassa's Oracle, and because you have so many Gyrutas in play, you might be able to hit the Thassa's condition even with 8 or 12 cards left in your library.
Yeah, what really makes this deck tick is the combination of Paradise Druid and Sylvan Caryatid, which just gets you to 6 mana fast enough that there's not many decks in Pioneer that Goldfish, like, turn 4, even. Even if all you're doing is very little, you can block with your Caryatid on turn 2. It's not too hard to survive to Kaskai Ruta, and typically the best ways to answer combo decks with a singular card they really need is with discard, but Garuda gets tucked away in your companion zone and can't be hit, and so it's really only vulnerable to counter magic.
Yeah, and this is we talked about this last week, but the whole companion mechanic is allegedly like a restriction breeds creativity, but not really, because once someone found this out, and I think Caleb Durward, who is a wonderful streamer, everyone should check him out when they get a chance, he posted a similar list before the set was released in Legacy. I think that's the genesis. That's the first time I'd ever heard of it, so that was several days ago. And yeah, once you do that, all these other card choices are kind of set. There's no like creativity being used. All these are just locked pieces. And again, we figure out the puzzle, you just execute it the same way every time. And like Damon says, the one Garuda is always in your command zone, so you can always cast it, and it can only be interacted with by a very specific suite of spells. The deck itself has no interaction at all, just tries to, you know, win without playing actual magic. And this is exactly, I think, a problem with the companion mechanic, like made very manifest. Everyone's doing the exact same thing in all different formats, and with basically the same suite of cards.
Yeah.
And it's totally random, by the way. You can miss on your first one. Like each chance, you've got like a 4.5% chance to miss. So once you cast Garuda, you just win or don't win. Basically, you're just flipping a series of coins that are weighted a certain way.
Yeah, although I think that the way these decks are built is that even if you don't like go infinite with it, you still actually might just dump a lot of value onto the board because the Spark Doubles, the regular clones copying Garuda, well, you only have one to survive, so you don't really get extra value. You just get more mill triggers. But Spark Double, for example, just, you know, you might have 3 6-6s at the end of this, and that's actually quite strong.
Right, but my point is, whether you hit a Spark Double or whether you hit an Altered Ego, that is just up to the gods, right? You have no way of controlling the top 4 cards of your library.
Yeah.
If this deck does turn out to take over the metagame, and again, we have to specify what format we're talking about, because people are trying it in literally every format, but let's take the Pioneer version, for example, where the play pattern would be turn 2 Accelerator, turn 3 you play a 4-drop clone, copy an Accelerator, turn 4 you have your 6 mana available for Garuda. How do you actually stop that? You can't actually do it with Graveyard Hate, and that's the thing that really caught me by surprise. I think it caught a lot of people by surprise, because Garuda looks like, you know, you flips 4 cards in the graveyard, so a Rest in Peace will just shut down any nonsense. Well, it turns out that doesn't work. The Garuda trigger tracks the movement of those cards. It says it will let you grab one card from among the cards that it flipped, and it actually doesn't care what zone they're in. So even if there is like a Leyline of the Void in play that exiles the cards, Garuda can still pluck them out of exile. So that cuts off one of the major lines of interaction. That leaves you relying on something like Counterspell, possibly, which there are ways around. So it's a little concerning. There's a card, Dranith Magistrate, from Ikoria that prevents your opponent from casting things from outside of their hand. That actually is one of the few ways to shut down companions entirely, so that might be a card to consider putting in your sideboard if this turns out to be like a long-term menace, or it could just get banned.
The problem is that card is just so anemic. It's 2 mana for a 1/3.
Yeah, it joins the long list of cards that they print in white that allegedly control this mechanic, much like they printed Solemnity to stop energy, that you literally just lose if you put it in your deck or sideboard. So it is an absolutely august company for how like poorly Wizards understands its own mechanic. And it's like Safety Valve is a card that doesn't really interact with it in a profitable way. Like Disdainful Stroke is the best way to deal with this.
Yeah. Like if it was like 1 and a white for a 3/2 first strike lifelink with the same text, like, yeah, now we're talking. You know, you can actually like put this in your Mono White Heliod deck and just eat these companion decks for breakfast. But like 1 and a white for a 1/3 is just, it just, you can never main deck that card. It's completely bad. And if you sideboard it, then, oh yeah, they can't cast Garuda out of their companion zone, but they also just play 3 main deck.
Did you say 1 and a white for a 3/2 first strike lifelink?
Honestly, how broken would that card be, Dan?
It'd be okay.
Like, well, what it should be is a companion. It's like if all your other creatures are white, you can play this as your companion.
Oh, there we go.
I mean, think of like Tomic, right? Tomic is like this card that's a 2/3 flyer for 2 mana that happens to host land strategies. The stats there are just substantially superior to this new one. Perhaps 3/2 first strike lifelink is a little bit too much.
The other thing you could print or that you can play is cards that shut out come into play abilities. So there's the 1/3 for 2. Again, I don't think that's a main deckable card unless you're doing something weird with like Uro or something. And you can play the 2/1 flash that shuts down come into play abilities as well. And again, the deck plays literally in its opening game, no interaction. It does not try to play Magic in any way, shape, or form. It just tries to get a 6-mana resolve, a sorcery speed spell, and then do nothing else. So you can any permanent you have in your main deck that interacts with it just stops the deck. So if you just resolve a 2-1, unless they clone it a bunch of times and attack you with a bunch of 2-1s, they can't win. And in their sideboard, the sideboards I'm seeing have like 2 bounce spells and like 4 Thought Knot Seers. So again, this is not a deck that's trying to really play Magic. It is the kind of glass cannon we talk about. So it might warp the metagame because, again, if its plan A is so good that people can't actually execute their plan A. But it's actually reasonably easy to stop if you're willing to always play blue.
Yeah, hopefully. Counterspells might work. I've seen lists already adopting a bunch of copies of Destiny Spinner from Theros Beyond Death, which is a 2-drop that says your creatures can't be countered anymore. If you find yourself paired up against us in Modern, God forbid, there's also things like Cavern of Souls. There's even Soul Land. There's Untidy Hay the Cloud Keeper. I've seen Heartless Summoning proposed as other ways to accelerate these out.
Yeah. At the very least, you can't play Teferi and Veil of Summer with Garuda, so at least one thing is fair about that constraint. Is it true that Grafdigger's Cave stops it? That the cards still come from the library?
Yeah. Yep.
But I think that Grafdigger's Cage doesn't stop it if there's a Rest in Peace in play, because then they're kind of coming from exile. Some of these cards hurt my brain.
Another card they could adopt is a Defense Grid. That's a 2-mana spell that makes it harder to counter. Obviously, doesn't stop your counter spells, but it makes Disdainful Stroke cost 5. So that's a pretty big ask.
Yeah, I guess the other thing you can do is you can just Path to Exile the Garuda in response to the trigger. But that really depends. That's a Modern thing. I don't know about Pioneer.
Yeah, I actually have not been in that. At least in Pioneer, there are ways to try to like fight back are much more limited. So I think in Pioneer, it's possible to hate it out. You just have to be prepared for it. I'm a little more worried about Legacy or Modern, and obviously Standard. I mean, they have no tools at all to fight it. So
yeah, although a bar in Legacy, like you can say, oh yeah, this deck can have turn 1 kills with LED or whatever. I mean, Storm has been doing that for years now, and it happens. Storm turn 1s you.
Yeah.
But it's not like a broken deck. It's clearly tier 1. The bar to be like better than some of the like Ad Nauseam Tendrils is very high. Of course, Ad Nauseam Tendrils gets to play Lurrus with no constraint or no cost. This has a 1-card smaller sideboard, so that deck may be pushed a little bit better too.
And one of the things that might be saving us from some broken companions is that there's actually like better companions. So like people have been talking about how good Lurrus is in Pioneer, but it's actually like those decks are getting dominated by the Orion decks. So it's like one companion, a good guy with a gun is saving us from a bad guy with a gun sort of situation. So it might be, you know, you ban one, and then that means that the slightly weaker one in a given format starts to take over. And it generates a cascading series of bans. So right now I'm rooting for Orion over Lurrus. So watching Orion win match after match against all the Lurrus decks is awesome. But maybe eventually that becomes the bad guy. You know, eventually you live long enough to become the villain. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, we thought that the big mutants were the Godzilla monsters, but it's actually the companions. Like, these are the kaiju.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that I noticed is I had sent you guys a handful of lists, you know, as we were starting to brew up stuff. And a lot of the lists that are already putting up results are only different from those by like 4 to 6 cards. So one of the things that's happening is because the restrictions are set in stone, right? The companions' restrictions are immutable. Once you start to look in those narrow forms, then you're locked in. So you see all the Garuda main decks basically look the same in each format. And if you look at Obosh or Lurrus, there's only so many permanents that cost 2 or less. So it's not brain surgery here. You look at your format, you pull up the relevant permanents that are spells that meet your requirement. And after you get to that point, like we said, it's like a gag that gets figured out once. And it's just someone telling you the, like, why did the chicken cross the road joke over and over again. So I'm a little dismayed as a brewer that there's like already basically no space to explore for some of these cards because of how tight those restrictions are. And like Damon says, a lot of them are just value plays. You play your normal game. Because some of these aren't asking for things that the decks aren't normally doing. You can just play a Bogles deck. You don't have to change a single card in your 75. And then you just have this like free recurrable e-witness effect that you just get Bogle after Bogle back or enchantment after enchantment back, whatever you require. And it changes the sideboard crazy because against Bogles, you always have to leave in all your removal because eventually they're going to play Lurrus. So
yeah, the looming threat of the Lurrus is actually like, it's almost like a false tempo. You have to respect it, even though it's like, it's not what they want to spend their turn on. But if you let them just go off with that, then yeah.
So we'll have to see how the various metagames move and shape themselves. But for now, I would say that the returns are more in line with the Zvi Mauschewitz, Sam Black analysis, and less in line with everybody who is as MPL an employee of WotC, who basically got this mechanic 100% wrong.
Yeah, it's a little scary that these companion decks are already doing extremely well in tournaments. Normally it takes like maybe a week for a really good list to be made out of new cards. And it happens so fast that, you know, what happens next week even.
It kind of reminds me, I think, Damon, you made this point with Hogak. The card had so much text on it, it basically said, like, you can't cast me from hand, so don't try. So try to imagine a way to cast it for free, and it gave you the two ways to do that, right? Delving or tapping your creatures for mana. So, like, once you, like, put that shell over it that forces you to do it a certain way, then everyone just built it to do that. And the companions remind me a lot of Hogak in that way. The text on the card forces you to do this thing, and the reward, instead of a free 8/8 trample, is all the various texts that the companions have. So, like, you just look at this text and you're like, oh, man, this brings up all these questions. Well, it turns out people on Twitter solved Hogak before the set was released, and we were already talking about maybe having to ban it before it was printed in paper. And that's kind of what this feels like now. Now, to be fair, the gap between electronic release and paper is so long, that doesn't necessarily mean it got broken super fast, because the paper release might be delayed for months now. But the parallels there between the text forcing you to make a series of decisions that lead inexorably to this broken state is very similar between Hogak and the companions.
Yeah, I agree. The only ones that really kind of don't fit that are, I guess, Urion and perhaps Lutri, in the sense that they have pretty generic looking restrictions and fairly generic effects. The one that I'm the most mad about right now is Giganta, because I was looking at, there was an article on greensunzenith.com, which is a website, if you're a Legacy Maverick fan, they have a lot of content for all sorts of new varieties of ways to build the deck. They have interviews with experienced Maverick players, etc. And they did a review of Ikoria cards, and people mentioned Giganta, and I was like, oh yeah, this actually slots in pretty well. Oh wait, I have to cut Palace Jailer. Ah, that's, you know, fine. I get a free 5/5. I have to cut Titania, Priestess of Argoth, my favorite card in the whole deck. I love that card. I'm not even sure it's like the right way to build the deck, but honestly, I will not go to a tournament with Maverick without her in the deck. It makes my day way... It brings joy into my heart every time I cast Titania. But somehow, she's cost 3 green-green, and Giganta says no.
But sacrifices have to be made to feed the beast, so...
I know.
Yeah, I agree that Urion is one of the less demanding ones in terms of what it makes you build your deck around, more or less, and so... It's no accident that was one of the ones that we decided to focus on first and make that our first card of the week for Ikoria. So we'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have some new lists for that companion. Stay with us.
Okay, welcome back. As Dan had mentioned, our card of the week is Urion, or Urion, Sky Nomad. This is the Azorius Commander. 3 Azorius Hybrid for a 4/5 Bird Serpent. The Companion Clause is one that I think kind of got people interested, because it lets you play 4 ofs of all the cards. If you're in love with a card like Damon, you'd slot it in there, because your starting deck gets to contain at least 20 cards more than the minimum deck size. 4/5 flying for 5 mana, that's a reasonable body for the cost. And then when Urion enters the battlefield, exile any number of other non-land permanents you own and control. Return those cards to the battlefield at the beginning of the next end step. So it sort of flicker wisps any number of non-land permanents that you control. So Dan, you want to walk us through some of the interesting rules notes for this particular card?
Yeah, I think this card is worth going through line by line for a second, just because it's a flicker effect, but as we know, every flicker effect in Magic works slightly differently, and that's especially relevant because if you're building a Urion deck full of permanents to blink, you might be putting more flicker effects in your deck, and just being aware of how they work and how they're different might trip you up. So just some quick notes. First of all, Urion blinks non-land permanents, but it is not limited to creatures, so you can blink your artifacts, you can blink your enchantments, you can blink as many as you want. You do have to own them, so it can't be any Claim the Firstborn shenanigans like that. The trigger does not target, so when you put the trigger onto the stack, you do not have to announce, oh, I'm blinking this, this, and this. The opponent will not see what you have blinked until the trigger has fully resolved. The cards return at the next end step, so some of flicker effects, like Ephemerate, will bring the card back right away. Urion brings it back on the next end step, and that has the possibility to create weird loops. For example, if you have something like a Restoration Angel in play, and you play Urion from your friend zone, on your end step, the Restoration Angel can come back, blink your eye, and trigger it again. Now what happens? Well, anything you blink on that trigger will just sort of be hanging out in exile until the very next end step, which is your opponent's end step. So you can kind of get in this situation where a permanent might stay out of play for the entire loop of a turn. And if you're familiar with the card Flicker Wisp, which is often played in conjunction with Aether Vial in Modern, Flicker Wisp shenanigans on the end step to remove permanents from the battlefield for a turn are also possible with Urion. That being said, what are some of the interactions that we want to take advantage of with Urion? Damon, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so the first one is you mentioned this kind of Restoration Angel stuff, and I view it as kind of like Kiki Jiki combo in slow motion, where you get infinite copy effects, but you only kind of get one of those per turn. But it basically gets you flicker your entire board, and so this lets you do things all the way from, you know, keep your board free so you can play a sweeper and not lose anything, to simply, you know, flicker two astrolabes a turn and draw four cards per turn cycle, which is insane. Then we have things like Treacherous Blessing, which Yoran basically lets you just run out of three cards in the Pioneer, where you don't sadly have Astrolabe. Note that Yoran doesn't target, and so the Blessing does not get sacrificed. Fires of Invention is a really interesting one in the sense that Flickering Fires, after you've hit your two spell a turn limit, lets you just use your remaining untapped lands to cast a third spell if you have access to that. And seeing as Yorion comes out of your sideboard, like the odds you have, you know, extra gas in hand are just a little bit higher. Sagas, Yorion gets to reset. So, for example, you know, there's this card Elspeth Conquers Death, which seems to be one of the premier sagas in Pioneer right now, and definitely in Standard. And Yorion lets you double up on that. Demonic Pact, which has not really seen a lot of serious play, which is this 2BB enchantment with, at the beginning of your upkeep, you choose one of four, and one of the four is you lose the game. And so you're kind of sadly forced to march towards that before you can either like donate it or basically flicker it and reset it. So Urion will give you a reliable way to save yourself, although if you get countered, you know, you might lose the game. Packs with demons don't always go well. Kiora Behemoth Beckoner is pretty sweet with Urion. You get to draw a card, and in particular the Kiora decks, a lot of times you have these opening hands with like a bunch of mana dorks, like two Kioras and some lands, and you're like, I can't keep this hand because of, what if I just draw lands for the first three turns? Then I'm literally casting a bunch of 1/1s. Whereas with Urion, you guarantee that you'll have a 4-power creature to ramp into, and that can do things like reset Kiora's loyalty, although honestly she has so much that that's not super relevant. Song of Creation is interesting. Urion triggers the draw 2 and then hides the song until your next end step. And so in particular, you don't hit that discard your hand clause for another turn cycle.
So those are some of the nice interactions that work really favorably with the wording of Urion's trigger and the timing. There are also some that are a little more awkward. They do still work, so you might want to consider these cards with Urion, but they don't work out quite as well as you might hope. So for example, if you blink a Planeswalker like a Teferi Time Raveler, you get to reset the loyalty, but because Teferi comes back on the end step, it's too late to activate at that turn. Similarly, if you blink Uro, you get another Uro trigger, but then it will have to go to the graveyard because it did not enter the battlefield from escape. We talked about some of the intricacies of the Flicker Wisp and Restoration Angel timing things. That might actually be desirable to do that. And with certain cards, like Thassa Deep Dwelling, just the timing of the end of turn triggers makes it hard to double up your effect. So like if you have a Thassa in play, the turn you cast Urion, you can blink one thing once, but you can't blink twice just because they won't be in play at the same time when the end of the turn comes around. Finally, Flickering will unmutate your creatures. This is perhaps not relevant if it turns out that Mutate is just not playable at all. Unmutating your creatures can be a nice benefit. We talked about how putting all your eggs into one creature means that you could lose everything to a single removal spell. Well, Flickering that would spread them out again, and you have a lot of creatures left over, but it will not re-trigger the when this mutates clause. So it's a medium interaction.
Yeah. So what happens if you play an 80-card deck? Just mathematically, a lot of things change. First is there's literally 33% more deck. But what does that mean in terms of your mana base? Do you play exactly, you know, proportionally more lands? Well, one comment is that the larger your deck, for a given ratio of lands and spells, you just are fundamentally more vulnerable to variance by about, for example, half a percentage point, give or take, in terms of like a probability of having less than two lands or more than five lands. I can tell you from experience that my Canlander deck, which plays a ton of cantrips, you can't play a land count like you can in Legacy, just because a 100-card deck effect is even more pronounced, where at like 38 lands or so, even with 10 cantrips, like the odds of having a one-lander were uncomfortably high. With 80, there's a hair more variance, and so you might need to play more lands. Especially because with Urion, you in particular guarantee that you'll have a thing to do with a lot of mana. if you have a really strong, you know, 4 of in your 60 card deck, when you play 80, you cannot increase that ratio at all. And so in this Soul Herder deck that Aspiring Spike has been playing a lot of, the best card in that deck seems to be Ephemerate. And now you have 4 out of 80 copies instead of 4 out of 60. And that's just a fundamental cost to playing Urien. And I think that's fair. I think that's reasonable. It does, unfortunately, mean that, you know, we talk a lot about kind of having, if you want to build some sort of synergy, critical mass type deck, you really want to have 8 of an effect to make it reliable that you see every game. But now with an 80 card deck, you know, even with 8, it's just less likely. You might want more like, you know, 9 or 10. And seeing as that frequently is just not possible due to the printings of cards, you know, most good engine effects, there just aren't, you know, there's maybe 2 copies if you're lucky, not 3. And so in particular, Urien seems to favor these kind of good stuff decks versus, you know, super strong like Enchantress type decks where you just need to play all the good Enchantresses.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have that much to add. I think the question always is Pioneer and Modern are both very reliant on sideboards to stabilize matchups, especially if other companions are leading to degenerate game states. So it is a legitimate weakness to not be able to see your sideboard cards very frequently. A lot of success for a lot of the brews we've had, especially in Modern, derives from the fact that you can tutor up sideboard cards. So you can still keep all your tutors, but your chances of naturally drawing those cards is, you know, reduced by the math that Damon explained. So that's the trade-off there. And that might be why Urien is maybe one of the quote-unquote more fair companions, because it does actually dilute your gameplay a little bit. It's not going to be as repetitive other than getting to cast your the world's best air elemental on turn 5 a reasonable amount of the time.
Yeah, so you won't draw your sideboard bullets as often. But on the flip side, that also means if you have a main deck bullet, like a one-off in your main deck that is a little situational, that arguably gets stronger because you'll draw it slightly less often than you would in a 60-card deck. So one approach would be to go for more of a toolbox-type strategy where you have cards that can pluck out these one-offs, and then also that would help you find your sideboard cards more reliably in game 2.
Yeah, the modern deck that Aspiring Spike has been playing a lot of, it used to be Ephemerate was by far the best card, and now it's actually unclear if it's just Court of Calling for this toolbox effect.
Yeah, so these are just some of the general heuristics for what happens when you try to increase your 60-card deck to an 80-card deck. There's also the separate question of, like, how does your game plan change when you have this companion sitting there ready to go every game? How do we think of that, and how do we incorporate that into our strategy as we build the deck and as we sort of plan out our turns?
Well, I think the main thing to consider is that Urien is a card that rewards you for playing lots of turns. So you want your, I think Damon was very eloquent as he described it. You're not trying to actively win the game. You're trying to not lose the game. And eventually you'll just have enough value. And it's even more pronounced now than in the Blink decks that had kind of been popularized by Gabriel Nassif maybe 6 months ago. This is just that on steroids now. So you're just, you know, your opponent can thought seize you as much as you want. This free 4-5 flyer that draws 2 or 3 cards is just going to replace all that stuff. So the weaknesses of your Urien deck are decks that are very narrow and that can end the game quickly. So we're talking about Storm, we're talking about Dredge, Neoform. If there's another new combo deck, maybe the Garuda deck. Those are cards or strategies that you're going to struggle to compete against. But the other ones that are like trying to trade card for card with you, this is much more like a Niv-Mizzet control strategy where you want the game to go to turn 20 and you're still going to have a full hand somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. So all that being said, how do we actually go about building decks with Urien? There's kind of 2 overall paths you can take. The first path, which is unfortunately the one that has already risen to the top of the metagame, is that you just find an existing deck that you can scale up to 80 pretty effectively without losing too much. Add 20 more cards, make sure you have some blink targets, and just call it a day. You know, Urien is worth a fair bit, whether that's just as a 4-5 flyer that you get for free that possibly draws a couple of cards. So, for example, the Urza deck in Modern plays plenty of cards that have ETB triggers, like Gilded Goose, Emry, Icefang Quetal, Astrolabe, Uro, Urza. And we're seeing some results with that already on day one, people doing well with 80-card Urza. Damon talked about Bant Snow Control in Modern as another deck that could easily scale up to 80. Same thing with Blue White and Pioneer. And we can imagine that also Bring to Light strategies in any format would be fairly comfortable accommodating Urien as well, whether that's Niv-Mizzet or whether that's even Bring to Light Scapeshift, a deck that in the past used to sometimes play 66 cards or something because of the mountain requirements of Valakut. So those are decks that just already exist and you just sort of magnify them a little bit and put some Uriens in. That's not super interesting, so we're not going to dwell on those too much.
I think those are actually like pretty bad shells for Urien. The reason they've been succeeding is that they're fundamentally Urien is a powerful card and they're playing powerful cards. But these are not lists I would try it in because the cards are so different from each other. you know, Urza is wildly different from Abundant Growth. Those cards are not similar. So when Damon talked about this last week, the reason he pointed out some of the Bant Blink decks is how similar all the cards are. Coiling Oracle is similar to Icevein Coatl, is similar to Wall of Blossoms. Uro is wildly different from Gilded Goose, is wildly different from Mox Amber. When you have cards that are so bifurcated in power, Cryptic Command is super powerful, Scrabbling Claws is not, then I'm a little less interested in saying, all right, we'll just decrease the times I draw Urza in my Urza deck. That is not, I think, the way that I would go.
A lot of these Urza decks honestly play Urza as just kind of like good stuff. We used to see a lot of these Urza Thopter Foundry decks that go infinite, but now Urza, honestly, like, they play Urza, they get a Karnstruct, they generate a couple mana off, you know, spare food or whatever. They maybe spin Urza three times a game at most when the game goes grindy, and that's fine. Like, that still actually is, like, a pretty good effect in Modern, especially because it lets you keep up mana from the extra mana Urza provides to keep up your Metallic Rebukes or Cryptics. But it's not, like, an effect that is necessary. Like, I don't think Urza is, like, by far the best card in those sorts of decks. I think it's just a good card. And so increasing it in these colors that already have a lot of access to a pretty deep card pool, you know, adding more Coatls to your more typical Urza Emery deck, it's fine. Abundant Growth is, you know, an interesting one. Nobody really knows on that. But Urien just plays, like, you know, it's a good card. And if you flicker an Urza, that's great. If you don't have an Urza in play, you know, it's also fine if you flicker an Icevein Coatl.
Yeah, so there's trade-offs that every deck will have to assess as they consider whether to scale up like that. The other approach to building Urien is to start from scratch and focus on what Urien does, specifically the Blink trigger, and build a deck around that. That's one of your synergy pieces. And since you'll have access to it every game, you know, can you craft a powerful strategy in that vein? So I think that is where, David, you had started your initial work on this. I'll turn it over to you here.
Yeah, so when we talked about this last week, I had really perked up my ears when Damon pointed out, you know, these Blink decks are basically just playing a bunch of, now they're not, some are better than others, but a bunch of replaceable 2-mana Blink cards. Ephemerate is a kind of a must-have in the Blink deck, but I think he and I had both talked about how good Cord becomes in that week. I have a love for Restoration Angel, and like I said, I'm going to want to play Restoration Angel in any deck that has Urien because it can double up on your value, and when you don't have 5 mana for Urien, Restoration Angel does, you know, a homeless man's impression of it. So I kind of have two decks here, and those two combine to sort of, I think Aspiring Spike has done a good job of kind of taking some of the concepts from both of these and putting them into the same deck and has had a ton of success. So one is sort of like a full-on tutoring effect. So you got 4 Court of Calling and 4 Eldritch Evolution, and you're trying to set up a Restoration Angel Kiki Jiki combo. Then you have a bunch of like 1 of tutor targets like Dan was talking about. So you have your 1 of Deputy Detention, 1 of Knight of Autumn, 1 of Magus of the Moon. E-Witness is kind of a key card. And then because this deck is trying to play Eldritch Evolution, you have like cards you can sack for value. So like Voice of Resurgence, The Walls, Icevein Coatl, etc. The key card I think that all these decks need to have is 4 Astrolabe. It's a free card that makes your draws more consistent. You want to see more of your deck. It helps your mana because we're going to get pretty adventurous with some of these mana bases. It blinks to Urien and it helps turn on your Icevein Coatl. So, I mean, the card is just broken. I think that it's one of the best cards in Modern. We've said it jokingly, but now I think we're saying it seriously. And so,
Shh, be quiet, Dave. Yeah. Don't get Astrolabe banned out of Niv.
This will not be the deck that does it. So that's kind of the first build. And I think like Damon had said, Aspiring Spike is already using 4 Court of Calling. You know, this just kind of leans heavier on the tutor package and has kind of less blink targets. So maybe it's less of a good deck in terms of value. And then another list I have is just a full-on Bant sort of value Urien. It just basically adds 20 cards to the existing shell and adds in like Restoration Angel to that. Now, an interesting point that Aspiring Spike has made is he considers his interaction card to be Avalanche Riders. So because of that, he's basically like cut all the Force of Negation, all the Path to Exile. I've seen it kind of work in some matchups and not in other matchups. I'm not sure if there's a way to kind of like square that circle in terms of maybe having some options. The problem is like putting some of these effects in your sideboard, as we talked about, they're really diluted unless they're creatures you can tutor for. So I still think it remains to be seen. And we've seen him shift his deck, you know, 10 to 12 cards between builds because it feels, it's funny, you go up to 80 cards and it already feels like you're kind of locked in on some of these spots. You know, you want to have 4 Astrolabe. you want to have ephemerate. And then once you get into the middle of how many one-ofs do you want that have certain effects and what's worth tutoring for, I'm not comfortable personally playing for Avalanche Rider. I haven't been impressed when I've actually seen him play him. It's a card I've seen him side all four out all the time. So yeah, I think there's just a bunch of different ways to build this. This is still one of the cards, I think, that has tons of options, and I'm excited to build in Modern because there's so many sweet cards that you can find one of room for.
Just a point of clarification, what David is talking about as the Bant list, we're essentially talking about Soul Herder and decks built around that. The Avalanche Rider or Soul Rider variant is very, very similar to the one that we talked about a few weeks back on our brew review episode. It was submitted by Blackfishy. And actually, the deck that Aspiring Spike is playing is a descendant of that deck indirectly. I don't know if he listens to our cast, but his viewers do. So they brewed that up on stream with reference to Blackfishy's list and with reference to the ephemerate deck that Lawson Zandy was telling us about a couple weeks back. And has continued to iterate since then and perform while adding Court of Callings, that kind of thing, while going up to 80 cards. So, yeah, when you hear us say the Bant value list, we're talking about, you know, a deck full of Ice Fangs and Eternal Witnesses, that sort of thing. The first list that Dave mentioned was more of a Kiki Chord.
And already just in those three lists that you're talking about wild differentiations in choices. So one of the things Lawson Zandy said is he hates Soul Herder, right? He had a Soul Herder list. Now, maybe when you go up to 80 cards, even he could be persuaded to put some amount of Soul Herders. Maybe we couldn't even twist his arm to put four Soul Herders in there. Maybe you want 4-mana Thassa as a target. You know, he wasn't playing Avalanche Rider at all in his list. You can play up to four, obviously. You could have a tutor package where maybe you just try to get the Magus of the Moon. Maybe you just have like a one Avalanche Rider you can go get because you got these tutors. I mean, there's just so many options. And what I found is, I was like, well, there's 80 cards. I can just kind of put in everything I want. But it's like, once you put in a certain amount of cards, you're like, all right, I have to actually cut like 20 cards from this list to make it work with the mana. And then, like Damon is saying, you need to be really smart about how many lands you put in because there is so much variation. So if you're playing like 8 mana dorks, maybe 29 lands is enough, but that's just me guessing. Maybe it's more, maybe it's less. You know, Arkham's Astrolabe is like a great Serum Visions, but it's not as good in terms of finding lands. So yeah, there's just so many variables, lots of levers you can switch. And if there's like one specific card you love and you just want to have it in there so you can always tutor it out, you can always just put a one of in there. It's like Dan says, it's never going to hurt you too bad if you're really in love with, you know, the one of Venser I try to sneak in all these lists. It's, or one Charming Prince. Yeah, can't be that bad.
Yeah, the deck actually, it has some really cool stuff going on. You mentioned a good point about how the interaction now is on the Avalanche Rider side versus stack or anti-permanent, you know, paths or Force of Negation type cards. And it seems to play out a lot better than I would have expected, in the sense that Avalanche Riders gives this deck some sort of inevitability as you go into the mid-game. That if you can get four triggers off Avalanche Riders in a game by turn 8, like, your opponent's going to be super, super hampered by that. They just kind of live in this shrinking universe. And then against people that kind of, like, you would want to have stack interaction, like Niobrand or something. Well, Niobrand might be trouble. But the deck has this new Court of Calling line for Kiki Resto, where you can go Cord, get E-Witness, E-Witness, get back Cord. Cord, get Resto, Resto, Flicker, E-Witness, get back Cord, Cord, get Kiki, win. And it's a little slow, but Cord's Convoke just goes such a long way here because the deck can vomit out so many creatures onto the battlefield that I've seen him combo people like turn 5 or turn 6 with this.
And then the best part is when you just naturally draw your like one of Kiki Jiki or two of or however many you want to play and one or two of Resto Angel, like you just get them on turn 4. They know how unlucky they were. Like, come on, man. You have 80 cards in your deck. Those are like tutor targets. You know, it's like when someone naturals Tron. Like, I'm not even searching for these Tron pieces, my man. I just kept the right 7.
A card that I'd like to see tried out in both of these shells, but I think more in the Kiki Jiki combo shell, is Vivian Monsters Advocate from Ikoria. We talked about this as having three abilities that are all active right away. You can play creatures off the top of the deck. That's nice. You can also make tokens. Fine. But the -2... lets you tutor up another creature when you cast a creature. So if you happen to have a Kiki Jiki in your hand, Vivian's -2 will find you the Resto Angel. That's cool if you do the Kiki, but also just like in a big deck, you want more ways to tutor. Vivian gives you that while also providing another layer of protection from decks that are just trying to grind you out. That's one of the historic weaknesses of Kiki combo creature-based decks, is that they can just have their stuff picked off one by one. Vivian seems to slot in perfectly to fight back on that axis, as well as Urion's Companion.
Yeah, one of my concerns with Vivian in this kind of shell, I agree that the tutoring is super sweet. I think the card is actually really powerful. And I wouldn't be surprised once we ban all these companions, we can go back to playing real Magic. If she replaces the 4-mana Vivian in the mono green Planeswalkers list in Pioneer. The problem here, though, is like Damon said, your 5 slot is Urien. I don't want to play anything but Urien ever on 5. And the minus, like, I never actually want to cast Kiki Jiki. I know in Aspiring Spikes list, it's almost impossible for him to cast Kiki Jiki. So, I don't want to say almost impossible. There's, over the course of 80 cards, he has like 7 red generating sources or something, but 4 of them are birds. So that specific line where you find the combo is not that available. Although it is true that with all these cycling creatures, you can probably like stack, play 2 mana, look at your top card, put it into play as another 2 mana cantrip. But I'd be loath to play that card. The one weakness Urien lists are not going to have is running out of stuff to do. They're going to want to play to the board more effectively. And she is a card that rewards you if your other cards play to the board, and she just kind of provides all the value. We already have the value engine in our companion, as I'm envisioning the deck.
Yeah, these decks wind up having tons of things to do just because every creature you play cantrips you into more creatures, and so mana gets really tight. One card that actually seems to be very effective against Urien is just very simple, Remand. You know, you're casting this 5-mana play, and Remand just lines up very effectively against it.
Hmm. Interesting.
Another card that it literally cannot beat is Torpor Orb. If you're playing a Karn sideboard, I would recommend putting one Torpor Orb in there in Pioneer or Modern. I think it's Pioneer legal, right? Or no, that's just Modern legal. I'm sorry.
Just Modern.
That card beats this deck by itself. Even in the sideboard, all the cards that would destroy it all are coming to play effects. So it's a very easy one of to just beat every Urien deck. I'd recommend putting one in there.
Yeah.
At least until they change their sideboard.
I've had Torpor Orb cast against me in Niv a few times, and I always look at the Knight of Autumns and just get sad.
At least you have Teferi or something, though.
Yeah.
Last point I'd like to make about these decks is that historically, within the Soul Herder archetype, there have been some discrepancies in whether the deck was playing any accelerators on one. Like, Nisias early versions didn't do anything on turn one except, you know, they had Path up or something. And then they started doing stuff on turn two and just really slowly accumulate a control endgame. Ultimately, you can just play a bunch of mana dorks and try to get on the board quicker. And I think that once you add Urien to the mix, you're strongly encouraged to go in that direction. You know, get your mana out there fast because you're going to have plenty of stuff to do. So I think the time of the no mana dork Soul Herder deck has passed.
Yeah, one of the concerns is that your deck was super susceptible to Wrath, right? You play all these cards out and mana dorks made you even more susceptible to it. It's also a deck that's very weak to Renin 6, and mana dorks are even more, make you even more susceptible. But yeah, you probably just have to live with it. The way Nassif got around it is he was playing 4 Utopia Sprawl for a long time, but with the rise of red-green midrange and how much land destruction they play, it feels so bad to let them like 2-for-1 you. Like, they play turn 1 Arbor Elf. Can you even cast Utopia Sprawl on your basic forest? Because the chances that they pillage your homeland, I mean, the game just basically ends on turn two, on their turn 2. You won't even get a second turn, really. So maybe you just have to just accept that you're going to get just wrecked by Renin 6. The thing that's positive is all the Renin 6 decks are really terrible matchups. So you'll win those easily, even though they'll kill all your mana dorks. And we'll have to see how feasible Wrath of God type of decks are. They may suffer from the companion effect because all their counter spells and stuff really start to get ground out when you have free sources of value in the late game.
Yeah, this is where Urien really changes how you can build a Soul Herder deck, in the sense that if you add 8 mana dorks, like, do you get to cut 8 lands? Like, no, not really. You get to cut maybe 4 lands, give or take. But now all of a sudden your deck just has 4 more mana sources than it used to. And with these kind of coadal decks, you just want to chain cantrip creatures. It's kind of like this nuclear reaction. Like, does every creature you have draw you below or above 1 card? Or 1 extra component of the reaction, and if the answer is below 1, then eventually you fizzle out. But with Urien, then as soon as you hit this point where you've kind of fizzled out because you drew too many mana sources, you just jam your Urien, and hopefully that draws you 3 cards and lets you start a new chain reaction.
It's also worth noting, like, Urien's body is so relevant. Obviously, you're not going out of your way to play Air Elemental in Modern, but the fact that it doesn't die to Bolt or Abrupt Decay or anything, like, it just blocks. It blocks Bloodbraid Elf or you know, bounces off a bunch of different sizes of Tarmogoyf.
It's no Niv-Mizzet, but
no, it's no Niv-Mizzet.
Still pretty good.
Yeah, exactly.
It's actually quite close to Niv-Mizzet. It's only 3 stats total off.
Niv-Mizzet is kind of like a companion if you take its recommendation that all your cards be guild-sized as a requirement.
Can you imagine if Niv was a companion? Oh my god.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Watsy, why did you... Oh, please.
I mean, they designed Niv as a commander card, and that's what you can do in Commander. You can make Niv your commander.
That's true.
I think it's also important to note, Aspiring Spike is playing these mana dorks specifically because Avalanche Riders is obviously better on turn 3 than turn 4. So I think it still remains to be seen. If you're playing Path as one of your one-drop things to be doing, which is a very efficient answer, you know, he was losing a lot to Uro-like effects because the deck has a hard time interacting with it. So other than, like, comboing over the top, the deck can't attack through it, and Uro helps mitigate the damage that Avalanche Riders is doing. So I think if you start taking the Avalanche Riders out, you can think about what you want to do as your turn one plays, and like 4 Path, 4 Mana Dork, 4 Astrolabe is probably enough. You don't have to do the full 8 mana guys if you're not trying to get cast the world's best Stone Rain. All right, so those are some options of what you can do in Modern. Now, Pioneer is kind of a different fish to fry. We haven't seen a lot of lists doing that well yet, but I think everyone just understands fundamentally that the companion mechanic is broken, and so I think it's something we want to explore. I have 2 lists here that are pretty speculative, that are built around lots of come-into-play effects. One is kind of a Urion's Monument, so it makes use of the sort of Oketra's Monument shell. For people who don't remember, Oketra's Monument is a 3-mana artifact. It makes all of your white creatures cost 1 colorless less. And whenever you cast a creature spell, you get a 1/1 warrior token with vigilance? It might not have vigilance.
We don't know.
So anyway, it was already encouraging you to play a bunch of cards that just kind of replace themselves, because if you have an Oketra's Monument in play, you're getting a bunch of extra 1/1s. So this list is sort of, you know, it's got Thraben Inspector, the best white card in Pioneer. It has Teferi Time Raveler, which I think is a really great card, and being able to bounce all these cards for value. I even snuck in a couple Panharmonicons just because you have a huge deck, so you might as well play this card. Militia Bugler is a card that finds more cards. Your interaction is sort of the Reflector Mage, Deputy Detention. Conclave Tribunal, with all these little 1/1s you get, is often, you know, a free spell. And kind of at the top, you have Urion, you know, that blinks all this, and it's even made cheaper by a Oketra's Monument, so it can often be a 4-drop. The other thing that's kind of something you can do, Shefnet Oasis is a card that buffs all your creatures. So if you have a bunch of crappy little 1/1s, all of a sudden you kind of give them that crusade effect. And then Westvale Abbey is a land that can turn all these creatures into, I forget the legendary name, but the 9/7 indestructible.
Ormondal.
Ormondal, yeah.
Profane Prince.
Yes, you can turn into the Profane Prince here. So yeah, this is kind of one shell I'm interested in tooling around with. You know, you get to play Thraben Inspector, so it can't be that bad.
This is a really interesting shell for me because Oketra's Monument is a deck named after one card, and it's a very unique card, plays a 4 of typically. Going up to 80 means you're only kind of playing 3 copies of it, roughly. That's not exact math, but whatever.
I think that's a reasonable way to think about it, though.
Which is maybe fine. I mean, it is legendary, and drawing the second copy sucks, but if the deck is noticeably weaker when it doesn't have Oketra's Monument in play, then I'm not sure you've gained that much by making this a Urion deck. So this will be sort of a test case, or it's just something to keep in mind as you take this deck into the queues. I have some concerns just looking at the creatures at each spot on the curve that without a monument making them cheaper, they're not quite up to the power level of just like playing elves and planeswalkers and Pioneer.
Yeah, I'm not sure I believe too much in Oketra's Monument as being all that good without Squadron Hawk. It notably doesn't really benefit from cards being flickered.
That's a good point. It doesn't benefit from the Urion blink itself, but cards like Aviary Mechanic, the standard decks used to play even Legion Conquistador as a 3-mana version of the Squadron Hawk. That's an option you could consider. Those cards are present, so you will get something good off your Urion, hopefully.
Yeah, Legion Conquistador is a very interesting one, because actually, this is a 4 of that you never want to draw 2 copies of. And so somehow going to 80 cards actually helps with the ratios of that kind of card.
Yeah, that's true. You drew all 4 Squadron Hawks in your 80-card deck. God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always tricky sometimes when getting like 3 Squadron Hawks will put you to 7 cards in hand, and getting the 4th will put you to 8. And it's like, well, do I get the 4th one and then have to discard it to hand size? That seems like a waste. I could just wait till I cast the 2nd one. On the other hand, the absolute worst draw on the deck at that point, if you don't get the 4th one, is your 4th Squadron Hawk.
Hawkward.
Yeah, Hawkward indeed, Dan.
Yeah.
And then another list I had is I've been tooling around since Pioneer was a format with the sort of Doom Foretold shell. Dan has forbidden me from using Demonic Pact as our card of the week, so I got to sneak it in because it's an awesome card with Urion. So you always have this blink effect. They printed Flicker of Fate, which is another card you can play, and you're already playing all these come into play permanents because you're trying to, you know, have stuff in play for Doom Foretold. So Birth of Meletus is a nice new addition that helps you, you know, kind of slow down these aggro decks. Trial of Ambition, Treacherous Blessing, as we mentioned, is a card that can get blinked by Urion. And you can get to play Gideon, which we know is a reasonable card against Inverter, whether Inverter remains ascendant because it was relying on Thoughtseize and you can't Thoughtseize companions. I think every Thoughtseize deck actually takes a pretty big hit. You know, we'll see. So maybe you can even cut the Gideons out of this after the companion mechanic chases away the Inverter decks. Then at the top end, you know, you don't want to play too many fives because, like I said, you kind of have the best five in your Urion, but I kind of have a smattering of cards that bring back other stuff. Eldest Reborn and Elspeth Conquers Death, both being able to rebuy Urion is actually really nice.
Yeah, it's both good having either way you do that, either those rebuying Urion or Urion basically rebuying those.
Yeah, exactly. And Elspeth Conquers Death, bringing Urion back with a +1/+1 counter, that's just a beautiful thing.
Almost Niv-Mizzet stats.
Yeah, exactly.
Not quite.
This is a great home for that Treacherous Blessing interaction, which is worth dwelling on because Treacherous Blessing says whenever it becomes a target of a spell or ability, you have to sacrifice it. So that's why you can't Teferi, Time Raveler, bounce your own Treacherous Blessing for max value. We haven't really given this Doom Foretold archetype a huge amount of consideration because it's a little slow, but maybe that's an axis of power that is just really greatly increased in this style of deck now because of that Urion Treacherous draw six interaction. You don't have to play Enigmatic Incarnation to try to make your blessings suck less.
Yeah, exactly. And you can always, you know, kill your own blessing if you have to with Teferi or Flicker of Fate or something.
Yeah, Final Payment's another one that limited All-Star. You can sack an enchantment to kill a creature. That lets you sack your blessing or your Demonic Pact if that's what the situation calls for.
Yeah. One question about this deck is Doom Foretold actually that good in this?
I think so.
A lot of the other cards are good.
I think it is. I mean, this is one of the first things that you were exploring, David, when Pioneer as a format was announced, was sort of Doom Foretold Starfield. And that combination itself was often enough to lock up a game.
Yeah, I think you just have a bunch of random stuff around. You know, you can order your trigger such that you, like, sack your Birth of Meletus before you gain two life and lose it. And as an aggressive way to attack other Planeswalkers, Doom Foretold is really nice, I think.
Interesting. I have to say, I haven't played with it too much, but it just seems like, you know, if you want to be spending your mana on, like, Demonic Pact and things like that, and Urion, Doom Foretold is fairly expensive in terms of where it fits in your curve.
My rough sense, and David, you can correct me on this, is that Doom Foretold is the play you want on turn four because it kind of has an enter the battlefield trigger, right? You play it, and then next turn, it's already doing something. They have to lose a permanent. Demonic Pact does not do that. Demonic Pact, you play it, and you just have to pass. It's not the best turn four play. Doom Foretold is the one that keeps you sort of in the game tempo-wise until your overwhelming advantage pulls you ahead.
Yeah, although arguably, because it takes time to activate Demonic Pact, the longer you wait, the kind of the worse it gets almost.
But that's not Doom Foretold's fault. That's what I'm saying.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
Pact has its own thing. Doom Foretold is a good play. It's the one you want on four.
Yeah. I guess what I'm wondering is, do Demonic Pact and Doom Foretold like play well in the same deck? Are they kind of like two different things of how you want to execute your game plan around maintaining Demonic Pact in play versus a game plan around Doom Foretold in play? I guess we'll find out. They do play well together in a sense where you can always sack Demonic Pact to Doom Foretold. It just in terms of, you know, you can only play so many four CMC plays. Okay, we'll find out.
Something to test. One other concept in Pioneer that I'm interested in with Urion is revisiting the Niv-Mizzet Fires of Invention deck that we had initially tried exploring early in Pioneer. That ended up not being the build of Niv that went on to more success at the Players Tour level. I haven't seen too many people experimenting with it, but I think it might be interesting to take another look at that build because of this interaction that we were talking about between Fires and Urion. The idea being that once you have the Fires in play, Urion is like, that can be your second free spell that then removes the Fires, hides it out of the battlefield for a while, and you suddenly have all your mana untapped without the restrictions. You can cast more spells. Then the Fires comes back, and you're good to go next turn. So it's basically a matter of increasing a Niv-Mizzet deck to 80 cards, and that gives you a little more slots for Fires of Invention. That also helps you. One of the problems we had with the Fires build was that Fires is not a gilded card, so it diluted your Niv hits. Well, that dilution is somewhat mitigated when you have 80 cards to work with. So I'll just post a list that I kind of roughly sketched out. It is a deck that's a little bit heavier on lands. I think I have 37, but I'm wondering if I should go even higher, maybe 38, 39. The Triomes seem like a great fit for this deck, and those are another way to sort of mitigate flooding. So possibly it should be as high as like 40 lands. There's some question of like what is the right mana support. Gilded Goose and Sylvan Caryatid are what are in the current 60-card Niv decks. But if you're trying to make land drops for fires and also play a high land count because of Triomes, maybe you should be looking more at more Growth Spirals, more Arboreal Grazers even. That's a card that Urion can blink. So it's a bit of a simple concept, but something that I think might actually be more powerful now, tipping the scales back in the fires build's favor.
Yeah, unlike the modern version, in Pioneer, there's no kind of single best card that you really like lament having to dilute. You know, for example, Astrolabe, Pillar, and Renin 6 are all kind of pillars of the modern deck. In Pioneer, you know, you have four Sylvan Caryatid, but you can always play Paradise Druid as like a, you know, not that much worse 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th copy. Growth Spiral is right up in there in terms of how good it is. And meanwhile, we already have, you know, probably more than enough Niv effects with 4 Niv and 4 Bring to Light to the point where you probably don't even max out that number. But when you go to 80, you just can do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. This is something that I might tool around with. I'll report back next week on my findings. But yeah, there's a lot of possibilities for Urion in Pioneer.
Yeah, what's interesting is if all you have to do is cut a single Enter the God Eternals, then you could also play Gigantha.
Yeah, Niv could support like 3 different companions.
Yeah.
You could have them all on your sideboard and choose a different one every game just to throw them off balance.
Yeah.
So any final thoughts on Urion the Sky Nomad?
Yeah, it looks fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the card that, unlike the other ones, doesn't have a simple like equation that just can be solved very easily. We see even people having successful decks iterating by 10 or 12 cards per league, finding success, and it's going to be impossible to know the exact perfect configuration because especially people who, you know, played a lot of Birthing Pod or whatever, you know, the permutations of cards you can have at each individual spot on the curve and how they interact is really broad. So the fact that it's kind of a never-ending puzzle and you never know if you quote-unquote have it right is pretty exciting.
Yeah. I think Urion is one of the ones that the chatter right now seems to be that it's trending towards the broken side of things. It's one of the more powerful companions. That's actually partly why we decided to tackle it head-on, because 2 weeks from now, it might not even be a brew anymore if it's just like the Urion meta in all formats. But we love this style of deck. We love this style of effect. I thought it'd be a nice sort of full circle thing. This is episode 51, so almost a full year now for us. And our very first show was about Restoration Angel. We didn't release that episode, but our pre-episode one. So it was kind of nice to sort of revisit our old friend, and I'm excited to go into the queues and start blinking things.
Yeah, anytime I have an excuse to put a Restoration Angel into a bunch of decks, it can't be that bad.
All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we are going to open up our Brewer's Mailbag. We solicited some of our patrons and listeners to send us their questions about brewing or about Ikoria or whatever else is on their minds, and we will talk through some of those. Stick around.
All right, welcome back. So, as Dan said, we are opening up the mailbag. Cave Dan put out a request to our patrons to submit questions if they had anything that they've been, this was on their mind, they want us to answer. We got a surprising number of responses back, so we might do this a little more often. So, we will just start out with some brewing related questions. First, we have Bromat Courier. He asks a multi-part question. What card from Ikoria are you most excited to brew around? Is Drannis Stinger Constructed playable? And how do you feel about the Triomes in Eternal formats? He thinks that they might just be okay at best. Damon, you want to answer those first?
Yeah, the card I'm most excited to brew around is Riel the Everwise. Being this Izzet wizard makes me think straight back to Adelies. In particular, I don't think there's going to be anything super good to brew with this, but I always kind of like these decks that can almost be good. Drannis Stinger being constructed playable, that's a no for me, dog. And then Triomes... Perhaps like a single Triumph in a Niv deck. I played Scattered Groves and Irrigated Farmland, you know, but cycling 3 is kind of expensive, a lot worse than cycling 2. It's very easy to say, oh, I have nothing to do until turn 3, I'll just cycle on turn 2. But to do nothing until turn 4, taking turn 3 off is a lot more.
For me, I think I'm most excited to brew around Gigantha, the Wellspring. It's a little weird because my excitement level kind of depends on how explored I think a card already is. I might get excited about something, and then if everyone else is already on it, I'm like, that's okay. So Gigantha is one that I think I feel like people are not respecting the tap ability enough, and I'm really drawn to that. Turn 1 Accelerator, turn 2, Rhythm of the Wild, Gigantha after that, Uncounterable, Haste, tap it, play Niv-Mizzet, attack. that's my dream, and I think that's what I'm most excited to make happen. As for the Joanna Stinger and the Triomes, I agree with what Damon said. What about you, Dave?
My most exciting card is Ninja of the Deep Waters. This is all after they banned the companions. Joanna Stinger, I can't imagine being constructed playable unless they actually start a precipitous drop in power level and then only, you know, maybe some kind of corner case in standard. And yeah, I think the Triomes are, you know, maybe a one or two of in certain specific builds. And like I said last week, in Pioneer, maybe in some Urien decks, because the mana is so bad, you actually want some Tri-lands. Again, a one or two of. But I think it'll be a great land in standard. It probably is the best come into play cycle that they printed.
When all the companions are banned from every constructed format, that's when the real work begins. On that day, we'll be in there with Ninja of the Deep Waters.
Exactly. All right, so Matt B. asks, do you ever revisit old brews that didn't work out when new sets are released? Anything from Ikoria that you're looking at to try in an old project? So any thoughts there, Dan?
For me, the brew that I keep coming back to is Kiora, Behemoth Beckoner. You've heard us talk about this plenty of times. Every set, there's new 5-drop toys, so I'm like drawn to that, like a moth to a flame. I'm also kind of drawn to Luminous Broodmoth as a card that's maybe interesting in some of these sacrifice builds that we didn't quite get there with. What about you guys?
Of the decks we've discussed on this podcast, the ones that I always come back to are, you know, just Niv, the different iterations. I feel like the aggro Niv decks we still have not really seen to be quite as good as the controlling versions. So I'm always curious to see if that, you know, Giganta Rhythm of the Wild enables that.
Yes, yes, it's happening. Lock it
exactly.
In.
Exactly.
Giganta week.
Yeah, and then like I think the Kiora deck also was a highlight, just slamming Glorybringers. And then I really liked the Didn't Say Please blue-black control deck.
Oh boy. David, how about you?
Yeah, there's a bunch of brews that didn't work. The one I'm kind of excited to try is like an Emry pile. I feel like Emry is a really powerful card. Basically sees almost no play in Pioneer at all. And so I'm going to keep tooling around with various ways to make that a thing.
Next question comes from Judge Rob, who asks, when you are looking for an interesting card to brew around, what does interesting mean to you?
So what I'm looking for is when you look at the card and you're like, interesting, and then you think about it for a little bit, and then at some point you realize like the card interacts extremely favorably with some other card. There's this moment where you go like, this is a really clever interaction or a really strong interaction. And what's funny is that after you get used to a deck, you kind of like forget how clever the idea originally was. So for example, like the first time I saw Oracle plus Inverter, I think, you know, a lot of people had this idea at the same time, but really seeing that deck become this thing that is just like such a well-oiled machine, how do you kind of identify that possibility out of a new card?
Yeah, and for me, interesting really interacts with, is it unique? So is it something we haven't seen before? And then is it reasonably costed? You know, are they making you pay a lot for whatever this uniqueness is? And then if something fits into my unique or into my sort of preferred play style, that really intrigues me. So like the Flash Octopus is already like a thing I'm kind of wanting to be doing anyway. And so another kind of tool that fits into that tool bag, it really encourages me to start fooling around with what that card might be able to do.
For my part, it's the cleverness thing that Damon mentioned. I'm not ashamed to admit it. That's a large driving force between the cards that I find myself drawn to. I tend to gravitate towards cards that have a high ceiling and also a very clear ask in terms of what they demand of you to make them work. Example, a card like Metalwork Colossus tells you right on the card what to do. It says, fill your deck with artifacts that are non-creatures. And then you get this 0-mana 11-11. Can you solve that? And if I think that a card like that can be solved in an unexpected way or in a way that I think might be good and other people are saying it can't be done, it can't be done, that's kind of the feeling I'm chasing when I'm picking cards like Niv-Mizzet or Colossus or even Citadel or something like that. It's a weakness in some respects, but that's also, gotta acknowledge, that's the fun of it for me.
Okay, so Brian M. asks, what metrics do you use to evaluate a brew's power? Sometimes decks feel powerful or have powerful interactions, but they don't seem to do well through the leagues. Other times, you may have a busted brew that just flops because of variance or a bad match spread. While we can still draw lessons from specific interactions or synergies despite a winning or losing record, how do you evaluate the deck as a whole? I can just say personally, I don't really consider the results in a league to be very relevant. One league is such a small sample size. You could, for instance, mulligan in every match. You could lose the die roll, etc. What often happens to me is I feel like the deck is powerful and I find myself losing a lot. And then I'm just like, oh, so that there's something there. That's the thing that is intriguing me to like keep working on the brew or maybe even run the same exact list back. And yeah, iterating on that approach, I think, is the much better way to do it as opposed to saying like, oh, I went 1-4 here, so the deck must be bad. That basically shouldn't mean anything. If you start losing a lot, then unfortunately, you have to listen to arithmetic, but one league basically means nothing.
One cheeky metric that I've been using lately is how much does it cost to rent the deck using the subscription service? And it's sad to say, but I've played a number of decks lately where when I load it into my rental account, it's like, okay, this deck will cost you 12 tickets to rent or something. I'm like, oh no, I'm in for a bad league. But then you add 4 Karn the Great Creator to your deck, like with that Aristocrat deck, and suddenly it's a 200 ticket deck and it does much better. So realistically, there's traps you could fall into. Like maybe it's not that your deck was powerful. Maybe it's just one or two cards was powerful. So that's something you should be on the lookout for as you're playing your games with the deck in the process of distilling what is actually good about the deck.
Yeah, I think personally, relative to Dan and Dave, I put a little more credence into the league win rates of a deck. I think these guys are both very far off of that onto the kind of feel of the deck. And I am kind of in the middle. You know, if you finish 2-3, it doesn't mean the deck is out. Especially if you finish 2-3 and realize, like, oh man, I had like this one card that seemed absolutely terrible and I'm definitely going to cut. You know, and at that point, hop back into a queue. If you aren't interested in the deck enough to want to immediately jump into another queue and prove it right, then that's a sign that the deck is not that good. And if over a few leagues you finish, you know, 4-11, you can talk about feel all you want, but statistically, it's just like extremely likely that the deck is not very good.
But we don't have any control over what our opponents registered or like what's going on their side. I don't like putting any kind of credence on match results. And that extends even to like when we celebrate people's 5-0s or I went 9-1 or something and the people post that on Twitter and like, oh, look, this deck must be good. And they just don't talk about the times when like they went 2-3, 2-3, 1-4. Just keep quiet about that and everyone is only seeing each other succeed, where these things are so meaningless in small sample size that I think for me it has to come back to more of a theory crafting, feel, intuitive side of things.
Well, you're clearing two things. So one is that there's like this sort of statistical sampling where people who get 5-0s proudly talk about them on Twitter. People that get 3-2s don't say anything. But from your own leagues, you don't have this sampling bias where you only have like kind of positive observations. And just statistically, like, you can say all you want about luck and feeling what your opponents are doing, but 15 matches, you know, a certain rate of wins, like the probability just says, like, it's just not that likely that your deck has an above 50% win rate. And you can say, oh, well, these leagues were all against, like, you know, weird brews or something, or like, but here's the thing is that, you know, you go to a GP, you're going to play against a bunch of weird decks. The MTGO scene isn't, like, that divorced from reality.
So as an example kind of both Damon and Dan's point, I've been tooling around with this Eldritch Evolution into Sunmare brew. And I had built it a bunch of different ways, and like I kept telling them in our like chat that we have, you know, this deck feels powerful, but I keep going 1-4, and I did that like several times. So like Damon says, there was enough data there that suggested that the win rate can't be over 50%, or it's very unlikely to be if you're going, you know, 3-12 or whatever. And yet the interactions between certain cards were such that the feel told me there must be something there. So I just had to make certain iterations on it. And then once I'd kind of made those adjustments, I went 4-1, 4-1 and only lost like literal nut draws in those two losses. And so that's kind of like the mesh. You get enough losses, you have to sort of face reality, like Damon's saying, that there's enough data there that there's something wrong. But certain interactions can shape your understanding, like, okay, when these kind of things start to happen, the deck is very powerful, and I just need to shave away these other interactions that are causing maybe the real results to occur the way that they are.
Next question comes from The Chur. What is a recent card you were most excited to brew around, but ultimately ended up being a failure? What would make it work next time?
So the most recent card is Enigmatic Incarnation, and I flagged it, I think, right when the set was spoiled that I would lose a bunch of ticks because I thought the card was maybe just not good enough, but it presented a really interesting challenge in terms of finding the right mix of creature spells, enchantments, ramp, etc. I don't know if it's fixable. I mean, the cards that you need to make it good would be so good in just generic decks that aren't using the Enigmatic Incarnation trigger that maybe the Enigmatic Incarnation would be the worst version of that. So, I mean, a bunch more enchantment creatures is probably what you'd have to have that are just on base rate really powerful so that your curve for Enigmatic Incarnation is functional. But the card might not be salvageable, but I'm fine with that. I've had fun playing around with it. What about you guys?
I'm going to go with Ox of Agonis. I hesitate to call it a failure because I think I did okay with it and it feels powerful to me, but it hasn't taken off in the ways that I hoped it would. So I'm going to guess that what's holding it back is the games where you either draw it without a discard outlet and you are kind of hoping to navigate the game to that state where the 5-mana play is good. That's a little tricky. So maybe just like one more playable main deck discard outlet, even like a soft one, more in the Seasoned Pyromancer vein, could help tip this towards being like a card you're happy to see every time.
Yeah, for me, the card is Kiora Behemoth Beckon Earth. I think, like with Dan, I really like this card, and I really want it to work. You know, think of this as like, you know, it's 2019, War of the Spark came out, your opponents are playing humans or a bunch of obnoxious planeswalkers, and you have Kiora into Glorybringer, and just wreck face. Think life is great. No coronavirus, you can go walk around freely. that's just not the world we live in right now on any of those axes. But somehow the modern format has come a long way, and the Kiora kind of soft restriction of needing a lot of creatures with four power has kind of just taken a turn for the worse, where like Klothys is now kind of a good red-green card that doesn't play well with Kiora. Glorybringer is good, but not at the peak, and so the card just doesn't quite have a deck that really... Kiora doesn't quite have a tier 1 or tier 1.5 deck to call home right now, and that just is a little bit sad to me. Dan has an interesting Obosh hypothesis with Kiora, which we'll have to try, but actually you'll note that Kiora doesn't trigger off Obosh.
Well, she does trigger off Urien, and I do have a copy of her in my Niv Fires deck, so...
Yeah.
So we'll see. The next question is one that I've struggled with. From Bin395, how do you decide how interactive to make your decks? I struggle with this because I tend to be attracted to critical mass cards where the solution to the riddle as I see it is to like put a bunch of some kind of effect in my deck, and it's always tempting to just skimp on interaction to fit in more synergy pieces, so I'm very interested in your guys' advice on this.
Yeah, so I have this simple formula that says that to win a game, you have to basically goldfish and also not die, and so the slower your goldfish, then the better your not die component has to be. It's not like a you know true linear mathematical addition or whatever. But generally speaking, if your deck can goldfish faster than most decks, then you can afford to put very little weight into not dying. Whereas if you're going to goldfish on turn 10 with your very slow control win con, then your focus on not dying has to be extremely high.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where I come down to. You have to decide how good your plan A is. If you execute your plan A and your opponent can just win through that or faster than that, then you actually have to interact with them. You're forced to. And that's one of the reasons that was the big shift in Pioneer is you can play all your, you know, tireless trackers and planeswalkers that are ticking up and down and back and forth. But if you're just dead to the interaction between, you know, inverter and no graveyard, then it doesn't matter what all that stuff is. If you're not interacting with that, then you're losing. So what you saw is everyone had to change their whole interaction suite, change the cards that they were playing, and they basically had to abandon their plan A's as they understood them to accommodate what Damon's saying. Their goldfish was not faster, and then they were just dying. So they had to really reemphasize not dying before they could proactively play the strategy they were hoping to perform.
Mana Symbol has a question that says, what is your favorite legacy legal card that's not legal in Modern, Modern legal card not legal in Pioneer, and Pioneer legal card, period?
Do you want to go first, Damon?
Sure. So for me, I haven't thought too much about legacy, but I would say actually True Name Nemesis. I think maybe a year ago, this card would probably have been too overpowered in Modern, as is. I'm not even sure it would actually see play. but I like that it gives you a sort of reliability in building decks, where this card is like, it kind of will take the game home in a certain way. It lets you lean on equipment a little bit more, things like that. And seeing as Plague Engineer is legal in Modern, that's honestly like the biggest reason why the card sucks in Legacy now. Modern legal card, not legal in Pioneer, I would say some combination of Path and Lightning Bolt. I think that lacking kind of this good removal in those colors really hurts them compared to Black getting Fatal Push and Thoughtseize. Pioneer legal card, I would say, is just Rala's Advisoroy. I wish that card had a home. I love that card. It's the blue-red Teferi.
I don't play a ton of Legacy, but my favorite Legacy legal card is probably Cabal Therapy, and it goes back to that interaction question. Cabal Therapy is really great in sacrifice synergy decks, and I love that style of sacrifice deck, but it's really hard to actually fit interaction in. So Cabal Therapy being a card that lets me do what I want with sacrifice while also providing the interaction that I might need to actually win, I'm just really happy it exists. And it's also like, you know, you feel so clever when you hit on a blind therapy. For Modern, probably the Border Post cycle. I know that's not really a playable card, but what I was saying about solving puzzles, I find that the Border Post, the way they're templated, they're three CMC cards that are also lands, that are also colored spells, that can be counted as artifacts. They end up being like the weirdo solution to a lot of the weird puzzles that I'm drawn to. So I have a lot of Border Posts in my collection at home, and I try to sneak them into our podcast decks from time to time. You may be hearing about a Karuga the Macro Sage Border Post deck at some point in the future. And finally, for Pioneer, since Damon didn't say it, I'm just going to say it, Niv-Mizzet Reborn. I think I associate that card so strongly with sort of the path of our podcast that it's just going to be a favorite for me. How about you, David?
So one of my favorite cards of all time is Sylvan Library. I have a Legend Sylvan Library that I got right when I started. It was such a unique effect. The card, the way the card functions has changed so much over the years. It's funny. You know, I've been playing it for 20 plus years, but it's operated differently depending on as they've retemplated it to try to make it work with how we understand Magic to work. And of course, Brainstorm is just a great card. As far as a modern legal card, not legal in Pioneer, Restoration Angel and Ninja of the Deep Hours are both cards that I love. And another card that I wish was legal in Pioneer, be so sweet there, is Necrotic Ooze. It's just too slow for Modern. It was just too slow in Modern, was a little more fair, and now it's just laughably bad in Modern, so I can never twist Dan's arm enough to make a Necrotic Ooze weak. But a reprint of that in Pioneer would be super sweet, and maybe even in Standard, I don't know. And then the Ninja of the Deep Waters, the new Octopus Flash Mutate card, is the card I like the most in Pioneer.
So we got a ton of great questions from our patrons. We focused on some of the brewing-related ones in this segment, but we also got a ton on the more personal side. We won't have time for all of them on this edition, unfortunately, but one that I think is maybe nice to close things out. Mark of the Warrior asks, what is each person's greatest Magic-related experience? Anything goes. Best competitive finish, an amazing late-night EDH game that went into the morning hours, a fond memory of a game with a friend who's no longer around, or testing a brew when you got that almost enlightenment level feeling that came over you. I just want to hear something positive.
Yeah, so for me, I played GP Vancouver, which is Ultimate Masters. And after playing a couple drafts online to practice, I remember losing to a very early Faithless Looting discard Treasure Cruise Living Lore on Treasure Cruise, getting 8-8. Getting smoked by this. They happened so fast that I couldn't handle it. So playing my win-in in game three, my opponent goes for this line, and I have, I forget the card name, I think it's Malevolent Whispers, it's basically Act of Treason, on their Living Lore right then, to steal their Living Lore, attack them for eight, sack it to draw three cards, and in particular keep them from sacking to draw three cards, which is basically like a virtual six or seven for one in my favor. And that was when I was like, I'm pretty clear I'm going to make day two. And that was very exciting for me.
That was Damon's greatest Magic experience. That was not his opponent's greatest experience. The time he did not make day two and got seven for one. How about you, Dave?
So we have a friend whose name is Doug, and we played a lot of casual Magic, especially when we were younger. And he was sort of notorious for making these decks that would basically not win. You know, they would play like Dueling Grounds and Corehaven and tons of Wrath of God effects, and it'd be these giant multiplayer games. They would take hours. And so in one of them, he had like the Dueling Grounds thing set up. So Dueling Grounds is an enchantment that only lets one creature attack a turn. And then Corehaven is a land that prevents a creature from doing damage. So for three mana a turn, he basically wasn't taking any damage from creatures. And he had no way to win, of course, except for he could loop Jester's Cap. So each turn, he would spend his turn going through my deck and removing three cards. So the whole time, he's just taunting me. He's like, you can't win. Like, I've taken all your win conditions out. I mean, the whole time, he's just, you know, you don't even have creatures left in there, dude. Trust me. So he's going through the deck, and he's just like, and it's, I mean, it's going on forever. I'm refusing to quit. You know, you're
just throw down, man. You got no win conditions left.
Yeah. And, you know, he's got like two cards left in his deck, and he's looping the Cap so he can't lose. So eventually, I drew Wheel of Fortune, and I just cast it without even thinking about it. It's like, all right, I mean, I just cast this. And he decked himself. He didn't have seven cards left. I mean, we've just been sitting there. He's been explaining to me for literally like 45 minutes how I could never win, like, what's wrong with me? And then I won the game, and like Red, who we've mentioned multiple times, he and I were just laughing and laughing. And, I mean, just never left it down. We've bring up that story frequently. But yeah, just imagine like the saltiest person on Magic Online just explaining how you can never beat them, and then somehow you just cast this random card that does unexpectedly. I wasn't even aware that this was like an out, so I'm not going to pretend like I was playing towards it, but it was just so great. He was just like, what? I guess I lose. And I was like, yeah, I guess I win. I don't know what happened here.
And he had the chance to take it out of your deck with the Jester's Cap.
Oh, I mean, literally, he was going to deck me. That was his only way to win. There were like 15 cards exiled. I mean, he'd gone through, every creature was gone. Oh man, it was so sweet.
Kitchen table casual multiplayer is like the purest format. Someday I'm going to make us like just restart the podcast as that instead of this nonsense competitive brewing stuff we're doing.
How about you, Dan?
I love this question from Mark of the Warrior. It made me think of a lot of specific places and people. And I'm like, yeah, I've been pretty blessed in my Magic life. A lot of possible experiences. But the one I kept coming back to is actually a store that Damon and I both sort of grew up in. Place in St. Paul, or technically in Falcon Heights in Minnesota. Source Comics and Games. This was in the olden days. So if you're thinking of like what is in-store play like now, it's like, oh, there's FNM and there's promos and stuff and you play standard or draft or whatever. This was long before all that, long before all that. It was like the Wild West of in-store play. And there was one person, his name is Greg Langer, who ran all the events there. And he was just the most creative and passionate person. So every week, the event on Tuesday night for Magic was just like some crazy format. What do I mean by that? Well, on the Tamer side of things, there was Tribal Wars, where your deck has to have 24 creatures of a tribe or something. But the winning tribe of each tournament would get banned from all future tournaments. So by the end, we were playing like Wall Tribal, that kind of thing. There was the Gauntlet, where you didn't just bring one deck. You had to bring a satchel full of three different decks, and you got to keep playing as long as you had one of your decks still alive in the event. MTG Smackdown was a format that was kind of like Sealed Deck, except that Greg had taken one of the giant Warhammer tables in the back, cleared it off, and just dumped thousands and thousands of bulk Magic cards onto the table. And each player would get 40 seconds with a little box to go stuff as many cards as they could into their little box from the Smackdown pile. And then that was what you would play a sealed deck with. So there was all this mini strategy, like, is it better to use your 40 seconds to root through the pile and try to see if you can spot a Dragon Whelp or something? Or should you just use your time to stuff as much as you can and maybe you'll get lucky and hit a stack of Pestilences or something that didn't get mixed around properly? Multiplayer Mayhem was a precursor to what we might think of as Plane Chase. I experienced it as Greg Langer running around the room with a stack of cards in his hand that was his Chaos deck, and every so often he'd show up at your table and be like, okay, everyone, you're getting a new Chaos card, get ready, and there's great fanfare, like, oh no, what's it gonna be, and you flip the card over, it's like, oh, it's a Mana Barbs, you're all underneath Mana Barbs for the next few turns until he remembers to come back and change your card. So those were some of the Tamer formats. The crowning achievement, and by far the weirdest and the most fun, was one called Survivor Magic. Do you remember this, Damon?
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't remember Survivor Magic? If you had been to this thing, you would have remembered it. So this was right when the TV show Survivor was like the new big thing on television. Survivor Magic was the implementation of the game show in a Magic tournament. So everyone who signed up was divided into two teams or two tribes. We would play our normal rounds, but then after each round, there would be all these super elaborate Survivor challenges that Greg had dreamed up. So like, okay, this round we're doing an art challenge, and Greg would give everyone a sheet where he'd put images from 50 different cards from Legends and Antiquities on them, and everyone had 60 seconds to try to identify as many as they could. If you won the challenge, you got immunity that round from the voting, because then what happened next was that the losing tribe from the round would have to vote one of their players off. So that's about an hour and a half in, and you finished one round and eliminated one person from the tournament. And it would just keep going, like, okay, after round two, the next team challenge is each team has to write a song about their favorite dragons in Magic and sing the song, and the winning team will get immunity from voting someone off that round. So you'd have, like, six or seven people huddled up in a corner trying to come up with a rap about Rorik's Bladewing and Croesus the Perjurer. We won that challenge, by the way. It was a great rap. But yeah, things like that just happened on a weekly basis at the Source, and it was just, like, a living manifestation of Greg's passion for Magic and his creativity, and he just willed this into existence. These Survivor tournaments took easily like 7 hours or more, so you'd be there from 5 p.m. until past midnight for what was ostensibly a four-round ordinary Tuesday event. Yeah, it's the kind of stuff you just don't see anymore in local game stores. Just thinking back on it, I was maybe even too young to appreciate it back then. But Greg, if you're out there, just want to say thanks for all the passion that you brought to that store and just like making it just a wonderful place to grow up and to spend time with this game that we've come to love.
Yeah, the Source was just a truly a magical place of our youth.
And it's still there?
Yeah, they moved locations. It's bigger than ever.
Yeah, it was fun to go in there the other day and see all these little kids running around learning how to play, trying to ask me rules questions and stuff like that. So put a smile on my face. That was, a couple months ago when you could still go to stores, but...
Yeah, the new location is in an old Hollywood video, so it doesn't have quite the charm. It's a more comfortable place, but I think something about just like being crowded in the back of this small strip mall area was a big part of it.
Yeah, there was this emergency exit that would set off an alarm, and there'd be a clear sign saying, don't go through this. And every time, every night, one person would go through, we'd all yell at them.
But like you said, David, I mean, stores, we can't go there now. And I think for a lot of people, going to FNM or their LGS or whatever is a big part of what makes Magic feel like home for them. And that's something that's missing right now. And we hope that in some way, just spending this time with us talking about Magic can fill some of that void. I know it's just not the same when you're playing online against people. But if you have a store that you like to go to, maybe see if there's anything that you can do to support them, whether that's buy something from them. I think we're all in for sort of a tough time in that respect, especially the LGSs. So do what you can to help out the communities that matter to you and that have been positive in your life.
Buying gift certificates is basically like a no-interest loan to these stores. So that is a super helpful way to give them money, but you're not just donating money to them. You're still getting something out of it. So that's something I would highly recommend.
Yeah, great suggestion. Okay, so I think we'll cut it here. Thanks again to everyone who submitted a question. There are a few more we are not going to get to, but we'll post some of our thoughts on that in the extended show notes. And maybe we'll have to have another mailbag segment down the road.
Yeah, so until next week, stay safe, stay healthy, and have fun with companions before we all get massively sick of them.
Then the real work begins.
Yes.
All right, take care.
Take care, gentlemen.
That'll do it for this edition of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. You can find the deck list from today's show at faithlessbrewing.podbean.com or in the episode description in your podcast player. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please be so kind as to leave us a rating and review. Faithless Brewing is a listener-supported show. We rely on brewers like you to help us improve the show and bring you better content. So if you like what you heard and would like to lend us your support, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. All patrons get access to our Discord channel and other cool rewards, but more important than that, the contributions of our supporters are what allow this show to get made. So thank you again to all of our patrons and all of our listeners. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will see you next week.